I'd like now to welcome Niels Christofferson. He's executive director of Wallowa Resources. It's a community-based nonprofit in Oregon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So you are working for many years now with this nonprofit that is looking at forests and community development and landscape in northeastern Oregon. You are here at the Kivira Coalition. It's part of our Kivira Coalition series. You actually worked in southern Africa, where conservation really can be done successfully only when it's done in collaboration with local people whose livelihood is their land. Describe a little bit what happened there, what you saw, both successes and failures.
Well, the main thing for me was the success I saw during the 90s with a variety of experiments across southern Africa in devolving resource management rights to villages and districts, and then partnering between the government agencies, the Department of Wildlife and National Parks, and international NGOs like WWF Africa and others, and IUCN, who partnered with the local village councils and district councils to help build their capacity and their management plans and support that devolutionary experiment. And it really, it empowered those local communities to take a whole different view of their relationship with the land and the wildlife, in particular elephants and rhinos. And it began to change because they began to have more say over the management and begin to benefit directly from the management of those wildlife. Their support for poaching, the rates of deforestation for subsistence agriculture all began to change.
For the better.
I mean, and it was a variety of experiments that were happening and I had a variety of experience with projects in Botswana, Namibia, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, a really interesting project in Mozambique. And as the communities were empowered and began to realize revenues from wildlife management, they began protecting and conserving them. Their relationships or their incentive to work with the poaching rings declined, and they started self-enforcement to stop that. And you saw the elephant populations and the rhino populations increase as household incomes increased, and they began to change their land management practices. So, because they were meeting more of their livelihood needs and their community investment needs through these wildlife projects, so they didn't need to clear as much land for subsistence agriculture.
You've described different kinds of conservation projects, and it was a kind of like a progression. First, conservation against the people, then conservation for the people, with the people, and then finally conservation by the people, which is what it sounds like you ended up with in southern Africa.
Yeah, although in southern Africa, I think we still saw conservation by the people being our aspiration, that we were sort of firmly in that part of the spectrum of conservation with the people, i.e. the government agencies and other, you know, larger national, international stakeholders forming a partnership with the people, but yes, empowering them to provide some leadership, right? So it wasn't, they were not minority, the local communities, villages, districts were not the minority partner, the inferior partner to that arrangement. They actually were the leading partner. But they definitely drew on some of the resources and expertise of the Department of National Parks and Wildlife to do aerial surveys, to assist with some of the scientific research about population trends and conditions, and also, you know, with a lot of other partners. So that, it was very much with, and we were still pushing on the evolution of these programs so that we really could get to a point of conservation by individuals, by families, by individual communities.
So from your perspective, how can what you learned there in Southern Africa be used in the U.S. where there are, you know, obvious differences? Like here we have a lot more land use that's for profit making than for subsistence, or some of both, but it's, you know, a lot of even small scale ranching is a for profit business. We have a history here which is much shorter, at least the Euro-American part of that history. How do you use one to think about the other?
So, I mean, when I first came back to the United States, with my wife and kids, and they were quite little at the time. I was so excited about what I had done in Southern Africa that I was looking, are there community groups and local government leaders that are showing the kind of progressive leadership and the understanding of what it takes to balance our social economic needs with environmental stewardship, right, with long-term environmental care. And through a variety of friends, found Wallowa County and what they were trying to do in their relationship with the federal land, which makes up a large part of that county. You know, it's, I guess, that I mean, if I'm just answering specifically your question, I think the most important thing is that we think about balancing the distribution of costs and benefits with conservation. If we set higher level aspirations for conservation, I think a good example, it may be controversial, but a good example is the reintroduction of wolves in eastern Oregon, where, you know, a large part of the Oregon public and the national public saw this as a very positive thing, but a very small number of landowners and a very small community bore the cost of this decision. And somehow we need to reconcile the costs and benefits and ensure that those that are bearing the costs on behalf of a greater public good are compensated from that and supported in that, and not marginalized and not demonized. And that, I think, sort of comes directly from my experience in Southern Africa.
We're talking to Niels Christofferson of Wallowa Resources. So you're based in Wallowa County in northeastern Oregon. What is that area like?
It's beautiful. It's incredibly beautiful. it is a gem with, you know, it's a large county, 2.2 million acres, 7,000 people, so relatively a lot of open land. 57% of that is National Forest System land, but it moves from 10,000-foot alpine mountains, the Wallowa Mountains in the Eagle Cap Wilderness, down to the Snake River, down to about 800 feet. So there's a huge amount of ecological and topographic diversity, canyon lands, you know, hot, dry canyon lands and big open bunch grass prairies, and then the mountains. And it's an incredibly beautiful place.
So in that place, and I guess it was probably around the time you got there, there was a precipitous decline in the timber industry. What happened?
So with the listing of salmonids, Chinook salmon and steelhead trout on the Endangered Species Act, and the uncertainty of the relationship between, in particular, timber harvest and the potential impacts of timber harvest on salmon habitat, they stopped all timber harvest for a period of 2 years. And because the federal lands hold the majority of the forested acres in Wallowa County, it's 57% of the total land, but about 72% of the forested acres fall on the National Forest System lands. You know, with that, the halt of timber harvest off there meant that there was no supply of logs to the mills, and three mills shut down, and about 35% plus or minus of the county's employment was lost overnight. So it created a tremendous amount of anger and fear and frustration, and a lot of angry reaction against the federal government and against environmental community that was seen to be responsible for this. But luckily, we had some very progressive and proactive county leaders who pulled people together and looked for a new and different way to respond to this, a more positive, progressive way to try to reorganize the community and create a plan that would help create jobs again. And that's where they created the nonprofit that I ended up working for.
When something like that happens, there are some of the expected consequences, like the ones you mentioned, you know, anger and reaction and unemployment. And there are also some really unexpected consequences.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, that's another lesson from that, you know, and that's when we fail to see social and ecological systems as integrated whole, and we begin to look at pieces in isolation and respond to concerns about individual pieces and forget the whole, I think there's always unintended consequences. And, you know, and in this case, when we lost employment, we saw an outflux of families That impacted our schools significantly. We had a 50% decline in school population, which then led to a 50% layoff in our teaching staff. It reduced the school week from a five-day school week to a four-day school week. It reduced the educational programming offered our kids by about 60%. But you also saw, like at our local rural hospital, that the forest sector had the highest paying jobs in the county, or some of the highest paying jobs in the county. And they also had health care benefits. And when all of these people lost their jobs, all of a sudden the ratio of insured to uninsured at our rural hospital flipped overnight from, 80%, 20% insured to 80%, 20% uninsured. And the rural hospital just about went bankrupt. And the community had to rally together and create a foundation to sort of plug the gap in funding to keep a hospital there. But there were also other implications that I don't think people realized, in that we didn't really have, because timber harvest had been an important part of the revenue model for the Forest Service, for the management of the National Forest System lands. When we shut off timber harvest, we didn't really think about what's the new financial plan, the business plan for managing our national forests. And because Congress has not yet really agreed, created a new unified vision of what it looks to manage our national forests today, we've had a significant loss in staff and in budgets, so that they don't really have the resources to manage the land that they are responsible for. And so you've seen a deterioration of infrastructure. The trail system, that a lot of it that was built by CCC, in the CCC era back in the 30s and 40s, that's deteriorating. A lot of the trailheads and recreational facilities and historic buildings are deteriorating. The road system is not well maintained. And there's just a lot of projects that are backing up, from, noxious weed projects to river restoration, et cetera, that they just don't have the funds to do.
And so in the face of all this, this organization that you are working with is bringing people together who have historically tended really not to work together. Maybe there's differences in culture, economics, history. What does this look like? Who are the different parties? And what was the common ground that they could find together?
Yeah. Again, I mean, the real credit first needs to go back to the county commissioners back in the early 90s. And their partners, including some the staff from the Nez Perce tribe and many others, that saw this significant change, external change that would impact the county, and began to work together on a county salmon habitat plan and pass that into county land use law, and just take a proactive step. But the most important thing that probably came out of that was the new relationships and this new idea of working together across stakeholders. And then as the mills shut down, and as we sort of kept working on a plan to restore jobs, but to restore jobs that would also restore the condition and health of our forests and our salmon habitat, we expanded those partnerships. More parties were invited to the table. And eventually there was enough confidence and outreach and trust built that the parties that had historically been severely at odds and often fighting each other in court battles over the management of the federal lands, were able to sit down together and focus our time and energy and effort on things that we agreed needed to be done to improve the forest, that in turn, by doing them, would create jobs and create economic opportunity for our workforce.
And so what did that look like specifically?
Initially it was small. You do start these things with small sort of incremental steps. So it started with little things, wetland restoration and aspen restoration and noxious weed management and fuel reduction. And then as you begin to demonstrate that it can work and more people have confidence that this is worth investing their time and energy in what can be difficult meetings, collaborative meetings, and not everybody's made to sit through those meetings.
Yeah.
Then we began to be more ambitious and start looking at larger watershed scales, start looking at, 100,000 acre plus scales, and crafting a bigger vision about the things we could do to improve the condition of the forest, to improve the condition of the rivers, but also improve opportunities for livestock grazers and hunters and fishermen and you know, recreationists in general, and then use that crafted agreement, which I guess Quivera calls the Radical Center and other groups in New Mexico have called the Zone of Agreement, but you use that as a basis then to support the Forest Service in getting these kinds of projects through NEPA and out to contracting and really create a larger pool of work for contractors.
So where does the money come from and who's getting the jobs?
Well, that's, you know, I mean, that's part of the collaborative is that as you scale up this amount of work, you need to also be looking at leveraging as much additional resources as you can. And there are several groups within our collaborative, our nonprofit being one, because we're positioned as a nonprofit to raise private donations, to pursue foundation grants, to pursue state and federal grants and contracts and et cetera. But we also have many other groups like that that were able to bring additional money to the table. And in Oregon, we were blessed because the Bonneville Power Authority has funding for watershed restoration. The Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board has specific funding for watershed restoration. So there's specific non-federal sources that we were also able to tap into and create a pool of money to do that work, create the arrangements with the Forest Service that would allow us to do some of that contracting directly. And we offer them as competitive contracts, but through our process, you know, we don't have to advertise nationally. We advertise within sort of the Northeast Oregon corner. And the vast majority of the work that we offer, if we have local contractors qualified, is going to those local contractors.
So to these 7,000 people who live in Wallowa County.
Yeah. And some of the people that live in Union County and Baker County, but yeah.
Yeah. Now, what were some of the sticky points? I mean, places that were difficult, where people dig in and find it hard to listen to each other and work together?
Well, we focused, you know, the first round, we kind of, we took the lowest hanging fruit. We dodged the hard things, which I think was right at the time. I think people look back in frustration now that we're done, that we didn't get more accomplished. But at the time, tensions were still pretty, you know, feelings were, the relationships weren't there to tackle the harder things right away. So initially we focused on the things that there were most agreement, and that was that in the hotter, drier, and warm, dry pine stands that had missed a lot of fire cycles because of decades of fire suppression and clearly were not in a natural condition, that those stands needed to be treated, that some of the previous road and other infrastructure work that had put in culverts, that those had not always been designed to consider fish passage, and that we could change those, change poorly designed culverts to open bottom arches or bridges or other structures that provide better fish passage and deal with some of the riparian channel restoration. Noxious weeds has been an issue within Wallowa County that they've cared about since the 20s. So that's, you know, investments in invasive plant species management is an easy one. So we focus more on a program like that. Where it gets more difficult as the collaboration has continued are the road system, right? Should we be closing roads or not? That's still a very hotly contested issue. And to some extent, as we move into higher elevations with more precipitation and you get into a colder, moister forest, mixed conifer forest that may not have missed as many fire cycles and may not have the same degree of immediate risk of a large wildfire today, active management in those areas can be difficult to reach agreement on.
We're talking to Niels Christofferson of Wallowa Resources. One of the things that I think is really interesting about your work, I mean, and we're here broadcasting in New Mexico, and I don't know if there's that much of a connection between northern New Mexico and northeastern Oregon, but what you have done is provide kind of a model of self-governance that brings a lot of different people to the table and creative governance. And that seems to have really spread throughout the Pacific Northwest, starting at your county.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. I think it's a very exciting place to work. And again, to work with some very thoughtful, and proactive county leaders and other sort of elder statesmen and women in the county But it would be wrong to attribute all of the success just to our area. At the same time that Chinook and Steelhead were being listed, the Northwest Forest Plan and the spotted owl issues were flaring up. So the same sort of impacts across Northern California, all of Oregon, Washington, into Idaho, Montana, were being felt in rural communities all over. And you saw an emergence in the early to mid-90s of a few different pockets of this type of innovation, the Applegate Partnership being a very well-known one, the Hayfork Watershed Research and Training Center in Trinity County, another one. And that helped, actually, because it provided each of us a place to compare results and ideas and to give each other moral support as we continued to do this. And it was the collective, I think, benefit of some of these early innovators and then some of the earliest adapters after that that began to create a critical mass and provide more confidence to everybody else that investing in building these collaborative relationships and these partnerships and this new approach really could pay dividends. And then it began to spread like wildfire. Although not just purely on the basis of those results, I think, you know, we also got support from Western delegations to Congress that began to look at modifying certain tools and modifying certain language that supported stewardship contracting and the notion of Forest Service planning, engaging collaboratives, engaging multi-party monitoring to improve our social learning in those relationships and the trust that what we were doing on the land was good, moving from low bid contracting to best value contracting and allowing for both higher performance in the contracting in the woods, which was, again, critical to trust that when we decide to do something, we do it really well, but also allowing some local contractors, providing a better competitive position because some of the criteria for best value contracting includes local economic benefit. And so you could score, you know, to the degree that you are helping employ local people or purchasing supplies within a community or even engaging a contractor based in that community, that provides a higher score in that type of contracting arrangement.
You've talked about stewardship economies, and I think it'd be interesting to contrast what a stewardship economy is versus a service model, recreation model, tourism model.
Sure. You know, for me, it's just a term we've coined to reflect Willamette County's values, which is we want to maintain a working relationship with the land, and that includes recreation, but at its core, it means that we're managing the land to still produce food and fiber and clean energy that our families and our communities and the larger society needs today, while also ensuring that we're maintaining the health of those systems and we're still providing clean water and protecting clean water and air quality and wildlife habitat. And so that you're able really to pursue the real vision of land conservation, which is about the conservation of biodiversity, but it's also about the sustainable use of that biodiversity to meet needs, and then ensuring as best as we can that the benefits from conservation and sustainable use are shared equally between the local communities and the larger communities. And a key really is, you know, to what degree are the non-market products, you know, to what degree can we reward landowners and reward the maintenance of working land for producing and maintaining clean water, healthy soils, wildlife habitat. That's going to be a key to the stewardship economy, that there is those kinds of incentives that allow for some different strategies to be used in managing land.
Ecosystem services, as
they're
called.
Right. Yeah. And that's, you know, I mean, that's had a tough go, certainly in Eastern Oregon, where it's been difficult to translate those concepts into meaningful transactions in Eastern Oregon. But eventually we got to figure that out one way or the other. You know, it's true, I think, not just for, I mean, the whole concept, I think, is also important for, like, in Oregon, the state forest lands, and across the country on the national forest system lands. Like I said earlier, when timber harvests, you know, dropped significantly by over 94% and revenues dropped by more than that from $37 million to $500,000, on the Wallowa-Whitman National Forest, we haven't had, you know, what's supposed to replace that revenue? And what's the, what does the country as a whole, the citizens of this country agree is the value for investment? And we haven't really come to grips with that yet, but we need to.
Niels Christofferson is Executive Director of Wallowa Resources, which is on the web at wallowaresources.org. I will link to it on my website. It's a community-based nonprofit, and he has been here at the Kivira Coalition Conference. Thank you, Niels, so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
This has been the last in a series of interviews with speakers from the Kivira Coalition Conference, which took place in Albuquerque a couple of weeks ago. Hope you enjoyed it. And do check out their website, KiviraCoalition.org.